In the distance, towards the walls of the greater room, the meta-room, or whatever it was, there was a suggestion of something. Something was casting complicated shadows, too far away to be clearly seen. Susan got up onto the dais. There was something odd about the things around her. Of course, there was everything odd about the things around her, but it was a huge, major oddness that was simply in their nature. She could ignore it. But there was an oddness on a human level. Everything was just slightly wrong, as if it had been made by someone who hadn't fully comprehended its purpose. There was a blotter on the oversized desk, but it was part of it, fused to the surface. The drawers were just raised areas of wood, impossible to open. Whoever had made the desk had seen desks, but hadn't understood deskishness. There was even some sort of desk ornament. It was just a slab of lead with a thread hanging down one side and a shiny round metal ball on the end of the thread. If you raised the ball, it swung down and thumped into the lead, just once. She didn't try to sit in the chair. There was a deep pit in the leather. Someone had spent a lot of time sitting there. She glanced at the spines of the books. They were in a language she couldn't understand. She trekked back to the distant door, went out into the hall, and tried the next door. A suspicion was beginning to form in her mind. The door led to another huge room, but this one was full of shelves, floor to distant, cloud-hung ceiling. Every shelf was lined with hourglasses. The sand pouring from the past to the future filled the room with a sound like surf, a noise made up of a billion small sounds. Susan walked between the shelves. It was like being in a crowd. Her eye was caught by a movement on a nearby shelf. In most of the hourglasses, the falling sand was a solid silver line, but in this one, just as she watched, the line vanished. The last grain of sand tumbled into the bottom bulb. The hourglass vanished with a small pop. A moment later, another one appeared in its place, with the faintest of pings. In front of her eyes, sand began to fall. And she was aware that this process was going on all over the room. Old hourglasses vanished, new ones took their place. She knew about this, too. She reached out and picked up a glass, bit her lip thoughtfully, and started to turn the thing upside down. Squeak! She spun round. The Death of Rats was on the shelf behind her. It raised an admonitory finger. All right, said Susan. She put the glass back in its place. Squeak! No, I haven't finished looking. Susan set off for the door, with the rat skittering across the floor after her. The third room turned out to be the bathroom. Susan hesitated. You expected hourglasses in this place. You expected the skull and bones motif. But you didn't expect the very large white porcelain tub, on its own raised podium, like a throne, with giant brass taps, and in faded blue letters just over the thing that held the plug chain, the words C.H. Lavatory and Son, Mollymog Street, Ankh-Morpork. You didn't expect the rubber duck. It was yellow. You didn't expect the soap. It was suitably bone white, but looked as if it had never been used. Beside it was a bar of orange soap, which certainly had been used. It was hardly more than a sliver. It smelled a lot like the vicious stuff used at school. The bath, though big, was a human thing. There was brown-lined crazing around the plug hole and a stain where the tap had dripped, but almost everything else had been designed by the person who hadn't understood deskishness and now hadn't understood ablutionology either. They'd created a towel rail an entire athletics team could have used for training. The black towels on it were fused onto it and were quite hard. Whoever actually used the bathroom probably dried themselves on the white and blue very worn towel with the initials YMRCIGBSAAM on it. There was even a lavatory, another fine example of C.H. Lavatory's porcelainic art, with the embossed frieze of green and blue flowers on the cistern. And again, like the bath and the soap, it suggested that this room had been built by someone, and then someone else had come along afterwards to add small details. Someone with a better knowledge of plumbing, for a start, and someone else who understood, really understood, that towels should be soft and capable of drying people, and soap should be capable of bubbles. You didn't expect any of it until you saw it, and then it was like seeing it again. The bald towel dropped off the rail and skipped across the floor until it fell away to reveal the death of rats. Squeak!
Oh, all right, said Susan. Where do you want me to go now?
The rat scurried to the open door and disappeared into the hall. Susan followed it to yet another door. She turned yet another handle. Another room within a room lay beyond. There was a tiny area of lighted tiling in the darkness, containing the distant vision of a table, a few chairs, a kitchen dresser, and someone. A hunched figure was sitting at the table. As Susan cautiously approached, she heard the rattle of cutlery on a plate. An old man was eating his supper very noisily. In between forkfuls, he was talking to himself with his mouth full. It was a kind of auto bad manners.
"It's not my fault, Spray. I was against it from the start, but, no, he has to go and..."
"Recover piece of ballistic sausage from table.
Start getting involved. I told him, it's not as if you're not involved."
"Stab unidentified fried object."
"Oh, no, that's not his way."
Spray, jab fork in the air.
"Once you get involved like that," I said, "how are you getting out? Tell me that."
"Make temporary egg and ketchup sandwich."
"But, oh, no."
Susan walked around the patch of carpet. The man took no notice. The death of rats shinned up the table leg and landed on a slice of fried bread.
"Oh, it's you. Squeak."
The old man looked around.
"Where? Where?"
Susan stepped onto the carpet. The man stood up so quickly that his chair fell over.
"Who the hell's are you?"
"Could you stop pointing that sharp bacon at me?"
"I ask you a question, young woman."
"I'm Susan."
This didn't sound enough.
"Duchess of Stowhelit," she added.
The man's wrinkled face wrinkled still further as he strove to comprehend this. Then he turned away and threw his hands up in the air.
"Oh, yes,"
he bawled to the room in general.
"That just puts the entire tin lid on it, that does."
He waved a finger at the death of rats, who leaned backwards.
"You cheating little rodent. Oh, yes, I smell a rat here."
"Squeak?"
The shaking finger stopped suddenly. The man spun around.
"How did you manage to walk through the wall?"
"I'm sorry," said Susan, backing away. "I didn't know there was one."
"What do you call this thing? Clatchian mist?"
The man slapped the air. The hippo of memory wallowed.
"Albert," said Susan.
"Right?" Albert thumped his forehead with the palm of his hand.
"Worse and worse. What have you been telling her?"
"He didn't tell me anything except squeak, and I don't know what that means," said Susan. "But look, there's no wall here. There's just..."
Albert wrenched open a drawer.
"Observe," he said sharply. "Hammer, right? Nail, right? Watch."
He hammered the nail into the air, about 5 feet up at the edge of the tiled area. It hung there.
"Wall," said Albert.
Susan reached out gingerly and touched the nail. It had a sticky feel, a little like static electricity.
"Well, it doesn't feel like a wall to me," she managed. "Squeak?"
Albert dropped the hammer on the table. He wasn't a small man, Susan realized. He was quite tall, but he walked with the kind of lopsided stoop normally associated with laboratory assistants of an Igor turn of mind.
"I give in," he said, wagging his finger at Susan again. "I told him no good had come of it. He started meddling, and next thing, a mere chit of a girl. Where'd you go?"
Susan walked over to the table while Albert waved his arms in the air trying to find her. There was a cheese board on the table and a snuff box, and a string of sausages. No fresh vegetables at all. Miss Butts advocated avoiding fried foods and eating plenty of vegetables for what she referred to as daily health. She put a lot of troubles down to an absence of daily health. Albert looked like the embodiment of them all as he scuttled around the kitchen, grabbing at the air. She sat in the chair as he danced past. Albert stopped moving and put his hand over one eye. Then he turned very carefully. The one visible eye was screwed up in a frantic effort of concentration. He squinted at the chair, his eye watering with effort.
"That's pretty good," he said quietly. "All right. You're here. The rat and the horse brought you, damn fool things. They think it's the right thing to do."
"What right thing to do?" said Susan. "And I'm not a... what you said."
Albert stared at her.
"The master could do that," he said at last. "It's part of the job. I expect you found you could do it a long time ago, eh? Not be noticed when you didn't want to be?
Squeak, said the Death of Rats.
What?
Said Albert.
Squeak? He says to tell you,
said Albert, wearily,
that a chit of a girl means a small girl. He thinks you may have misheard me.
Susan hunched up in the chair. Albert pulled up another one and sat down.
How old are you?
16.
Oh, my.
Albert rolled his eyes.
How long have you been 16?
Since I was 15, of course. Are you stupid?
My, 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 how the time does pass, said Albert. Do you know why you're here?
No, but, Susan hesitated, but it's got something to do with it. Something like, I'm seeing things that people don't see, and I've met someone who's just a story, and I know I've been here before, and all these skulls and bones on things.
Albert's rangy, vulture-like shape loomed over her.
Would you like a cocoa,
he said. It was a lot different from the cocoa at school, which was like hot brown water. Albert's cocoa had fat floating in it. If you turned the mug upside down, it would be a little while before anything fell out.
Your mum and dad,
said Albert, when she had a chocolate moustache that was far too young for her,
did they ever explain anything to you?
Miss Delcross did that in biology, said Susan. She got it wrong, she added.
I mean about your grandfather,
said Albert.
I remember things, said Susan, but I can't remember them until I've seen them, like the bathroom, like you.
Your mum and dad thought it best you forgot,
said Albert.
It's in the bone. They was afraid it was going to happen, and it has. You've inherited.
Oh, I know about that too, said Susan. It's all about mice and beans and things.
Albert gave her a blank look.
Look, I'll try to put it tactful, he said.
Susan gave him a polite look.
Your grandfather is death,
said Albert.
You know, the skeleton in the black robe. You rode in on his horse and this is his house, only he's gone away to think things over. Or something. What I reckon's happening is you're being sucked in. It's in the bone. You're old enough now. There's a hole and it thinks you're the right shape. I don't like it any more than you do.
Death, said Susan flatly. Well, I can't say I didn't have suspicions. Like the Hogfather and the Sandman and the Tooth Fairy.
Yes.
Squeak. You expect me to believe that, do you?
Said Susan, trying to summon up her most withering scorn. Albert glared back like someone who'd done all his withering a long time ago.
It's no skin off my nose what you believe, madam,
he said.
You really mean the tall figure with the scythe and everything?
Yes.
Look, Albert, said Susan, in the voice one uses to the simple-minded, even if there was a death like that, and frankly it's quite ridiculous to go anthropomorphizing a simple natural function, no one can inherit anything from it. I know about heredity. It's all about having red hair and things. You get it from other people. You don't get it from myths and legends. The Death of Rats had gravitated to the cheese board where he was using his scythe to hack off a lump. Albert sat back.
I remember when you got brought here,
he said.
He'd kept on asking, you see. He was curious. He likes kids. Sees a lot of them, really, but not to get to know, if you see what I mean. Your mum and dad didn't want to, but they gave in and brought you all here for tea one day just to keep him quiet. They didn't like to do it because they thought you'd be scared and scream the place down. But you, oh, you didn't scream. You laughed. Frightened the life out of your dad, that kid. They brought you a couple more times when he asked. But then they got scared about what might happen, and your dad put his foot down, and that was the end of it. He was about the only one who could argue with the master. your dad. He'd have been about 4 then, I think.
Susan raised her hand thoughtfully and touched the pale lines on her cheek.
The master said they were raising you according to...
Albert sneered.
Modern methods. Logic and thinking old stuff is silly. I don't know. I suppose they wanted to keep you away from ideas like this.
I was given a ride on the horse, said Susan, not listening to him. I had a bath in the big bathroom.
Soap all over the place,
said Albert, his face contorted into something approaching a smile.
I could hear the master laughing from here, and he made you a swing, too. Tried to, anyway. No magic or anything. With his actual hands.
Susan sat while memories woke and yawned and unfolded in her head. I remember about that bathroom now, she said. It's all coming back to me.
Nah, he never went away. He just got papered over.
He was no good at plumbing. What does YMRCIGBSAAM mean?
Young Men's Reformed Cultists of the Ekor God Bel Shamharoth Association, Ankh Morpork,
said Albert.
It's where I stay if I have to go back down for anything. Soap and such like.
But you're not, a young man, said Susan, unable to prevent herself.
No one argues,
he snapped. And Susan thought that was probably true. There was some kind of wiry strength in Albert, as if his whole body was a knuckle. He can make just about anything, she said, half to herself, but some things he just doesn't understand. And one of them's plumbing.
Right. We had to get a plumber from Ankh Morpork. He said he might be able to make it a week next Thursday, and you don't say that kind of thing to the master, said Albert. I've never seen a bugger work so fast. Then the master just made him forget. He can make everyone forget. Except...
Albert stopped and frowned.
Seems I've got to put up with it, he said. Seems you've a right. I expect you're tired. You can stay here. There's plenty of rooms.
No, I've got to get back. There'll be terrible trouble if I'm not at school in the morning.
There's no time here except what people brings with them. Things just happen one after the other. Binky'll take you right back to the time you left, if you like. But you ought to stop here a while.
You said there's a hole and I'm being sucked in. I don't know what that means.
You'll feel better after a sleep,
said Albert. There was no real day or night here. That had given Albert trouble at first. There was just the bright landscape, and above, a black sky with stars. Death had never got the hang of day and night. When the house had human inhabitants, it tended to keep a 26-hour day. Humans, left to themselves, adopt a longer diurnal rhythm than the 24-hour day, so they can be reset like a lot of little clocks at sunset. Humans have to put up with time, but days are a sort of personal option. Albert went to bed whenever he remembered. Now he sat up with one candle alight, staring into space.
She remembered about the bathroom, he muttered, and she knows about things she couldn't have seen. She couldn't have been told. She's got his memory. She inherited. Squeak,
said the Death of Rats. He tended to sit by the fire at nights.
Last time he went off, people stopped dying, said Albert. But they ain't stopped dying this time, and the horse went to her. She's filling the hole.
Albert glared at the darkness. When he was agitated, it showed by a sort of relentless chewing and sucking activity, as if he was trying to extract some forgotten morsel of tea time from the recesses of a tooth. Now he was making a noise like a hairdresser's U-bend. He couldn't remember ever having been young. It must have happened thousands of years ago. He was 79, but time in Death's house was a reusable resource. He was vaguely aware that childhood was a tricky business, especially towards the end. There was all the business with pimples and bits of your body having a mind of their own. Running the executive arm of mortality was certainly an extra problem. But the point was, the horrible, inescapable point was, that someone had to do it. For, as has been said before, death operated in general rather than particular terms, just like a monarchy. If you were a subject in a monarchy, you are ruled by the monarch, all the time, waking or sleeping, whatever you or they happen to be doing. It's part of the general conditions of the situation. The Queen doesn't actually have to come around to your actual house, hog the chair and the TV remote control, and issue actual commands about how one is parched and one would enjoy a cup of tea. It all takes place automatically, like gravity. Except that unlike gravity, it needs someone at the top. They don't necessarily have to do a great deal. They just have to be there. They just have to be.
Said Albert. Squeak! She'll crack soon enough, said Albert. Oh, yes. You can't be an immortal and a mortal at the same time. It'll tear you in half. I almost feel sorry for her.
Squeak, agreed the Death of Rats.
And that ain't the worst bit, said Albert. You wait till her memory really starts working.
Squeak.
You listen to me, said Albert. You'd better start looking for him right away.
Susan awoke and had no idea what time it was. There was a clock by the bedside, because Death knew there should be things like bedside clocks. It had skulls and bones and the Omega sign on it, and it didn't work. There were no working clocks in the house, except the special one in the hall. Any others got depressed and stopped or unwound themselves all in one go. Her room looked as though someone had moved out yesterday. There were hairbrushes on the dressing table and a few odds and ends of makeup. There was even a dressing gown on the back of the door. It had a rabbit on the pocket. The cosy effect would have been improved if it hadn't been a skeletal one. She had a rummage through the drawers. This must have been her mother's room. There was a lot of pink. Susan had nothing against pink, in moderation, but this wasn't it. She put on her old school dress. The important thing, she decided, was to stay calm. There was always a logical explanation for everything, even if you had to make it up.
Squiff!
The Death of Rats landed on the dressing room table, claws scrabbling for a purchase. He removed the tiny scythe from his jaws.
I think, said Susan carefully, that I would like to go home now, thank you.
The little rat nodded and leapt. It landed on the edge of the pink carpet and scurried away across the dark floor beyond. When Susan stepped off the carpet, the rat stopped and looked around in approval. Once again, she felt she'd passed some sort of test. She followed it out into the hall and then into the smoky cavern of the kitchen. Albert was bent over the stove.
"Morning," he said,
out of habit rather than any acknowledgement of the time of day.
"You want fried bread with your sausages? There's porridge to follow."
Susan looked at the mess sizzling in the huge frying pan. It wasn't a sight to be seen on an empty stomach, although it could probably cause one. Albert could make an egg wish it had never been laid.
"Haven't you got any muesli?" she said.
"Is that some kind of sausage?" said Albert suspiciously.
"It's nuts and grains."
"Any fat in it?"
"I don't think so."
"How are you supposed to fry it, then?"
"You don't fry it."
"You call that breakfast?"
"It doesn't have to be fried to be breakfast," said Susan. "I mean, you mentioned porridge, and you don't fry porridge."
"Who says?"
"A boiled egg, then?"
"Heh, boiling's no good. It don't kill off all the germs."
"Boil me an egg, Albert."
As the echoes bounced across and died away, Susan wondered where the voice had come from. Albert's ladle tinkled on the tiles.
"Please?" said Susan.
"You did the voice," said Albert.
"Don't bother about the egg," said Susan.
The voice had made her jaw ache. It worried her even more than it worried Albert. After all, it was her mouth.
"I want to go home."
"You are home," said Albert.
"This place, this isn't my home."
"Yeah? What's the inscription on the big clock?"
"Too late," said Susan promptly.
"Where are the beehives?"
"In the orchard."
"How many plates have we got?"
"7.
Susan shut her mouth firmly.
"See?
"'It's home to part of you,' said Albert. "'Look, Albert,' said Susan, trying sweet reason in case it worked any better this time around. "'Maybe there is someone sort of in charge of things, but I'm really no one special. I mean,
yeah, how come the horse knows you?'
"'Yes, but I really am just a normal girl.'
"'Normal girls didn't get a My Little Binky set on their third birthday.'
snapped Albert.
Your dad took it away. The master was very upset about that. He was trying.
I mean, I'm an ordinary kid.
Listen, ordinary kids get a xylophone. They don't just ask their granddad to take his shirt off.
I mean, I can't help it. That's not my fault. It's not fair.
Really? Oh, why didn't you say...
said Albert sourly.
That cuts a lot of thin ice, that does. I should just go out now if I was you and tell the universe that it's not fair. I bet it'll say, oh, all right then, sorry you be troubled. You'll let off.
That's sarcasm. You can't talk to me like that. You're just a servant.
That's right, and so are you. So I should get started if I was you. The rat'll help. He mainly does rats, but the principle's the same.
Susan sat with her mouth open.
I'm going outside, she snapped.
I ain't stopping you.
Susan stormed out through the back door, across the enormous expanses of the outer room, past the grindstone in the yard and into the garden.
Huh, she said.
If someone had told Susan that death had a house, she would have called them mad, or even worse, stupid. But if she'd had to imagine one... she'd have drawn, in sensible black crayon, some towering, battlemented Gothic mansion. It would loom and involve other words ending in oom, like gloom and doom. There would have been thousands of windows. She'd fill odd corners of the sky with bats. It would be impressive. It wouldn't be a cottage. It wouldn't have a rather tasteless garden. It wouldn't have a mat in front of the door with welcome on it. Susan had invincible walls of common sense. They were beginning to melt like salt in a wet wind, and that made her angry. There was Grandfather Lezek, of course, on his little farm so poor that even the sparrows had to kneel down to eat. He'd been a nice old chap, so far as she could recall. A bit sheepish, now she came to think about it, especially when her father was around. Her mother had told Susan that her own father had been... Now she came to think about that. She wasn't sure what her mother had told her. Parents were quite clever at not telling people things, even when they used a lot of words. She'd just been left with the impression that he wasn't around. Now it was being suggested that he was renowned for being around all the time. It was like having a relative in trade. A god, now, a god would be something. Lady Odile Flume, in the fifth form, was always boasting that her great-great-grandmother had once been seduced by the god Blind Io in the form of a vase of daisies, which apparently made her a demi-hemi-semi-goddess. She said her mother found it useful to get a table in restaurants. Saying you were a close relative of death probably would not have the same effect. You probably wouldn't even manage a seat near the kitchen. If it was all some kind of dream, she didn't seem at any risk of waking up. Anyway, she didn't believe that kind of thing. Dreams weren't like this. A path led from the stable yard past a vegetable garden and descending slightly into an orchard of black-leaved trees. Glossy black apples hung from them. Off to one side were some white beehives. And she knew she'd seen it all before. There was an apple tree that was quite different from the others. She stood and stared at it as memory flooded back. She remembered being just old enough to see how logically stupid the whole idea was, and he'd been standing there, anxiously waiting to see what she'd do. Old certainties drained away to be replaced by new certainties. Now she understood whose granddaughter she was. The mended drum had traditionally gone in for, well, traditional pub games, such as dominoes, darts, and stabbing people in the back and taking all their money... The new owner had decided to go upmarket. This was the only available direction. There had been the quizzing device, a 3-ton water-driven monstrosity based on a recently discovered design by Leonard of Quirm. It had been a bad idea. Captain Carrot of the Watch, who had a mind like a needle under his open smiling face, had surreptitiously substituted a new roll of questions, like, "Were you near Vortin's diamond warehouse on the night of the 15th? And who was the third man who did the blagging at Bearhugger's distillery last week? And had arrested three customers before they caught on. The owner had promised another machine any day now. The librarian, one of the tavern's regulars, had been collecting pennies in readiness. There was a small stage at one end of the bar. The owner had tried a lunchtime stripper, but only once. At the sight of a large orangutan in the front row with a big innocent grin, a big bag of penny pieces, and a big banana, the poor girl had fled. Yet another entertainment guild had blacklisted the drum. The new owner's name was Hibiscus Dunelm. It wasn't his fault. He really wanted to make the drum, he said, a fun place. For two pins, he'd have put stripy umbrellas outside. He looked down at Glod.
"Just three of you," he said.
"Yes."
"When I agreed to $5, you said you had a big band. Say hello, Leas."
"My word, that is a big band." Dunelm backed away. "I thought," he said, "just a few numbers that everyone knows, just to provide some ambience."
"Ambience," said Imp, looking around the drum. He was familiar with the word, but in a place like this it was all lost and alone. There were only three or four customers in at this early hour of the evening. They weren't paying any attention to the stage. The wall behind the stage had clearly seen action. He stared at it as Leas patiently stacked up his stones.
"Oh, just a bit of fruit and old eggs," said Glod. "People probably get a bit boisterous. I shouldn't worry about that."
"I'm not worried about it," said Imp.
"I should think not.
It's the axe marks and arrow holes I'm worried about. Glod, we haven't even practiced. Not properly."
"You can play your guitar, can't you?"
"Well, yes, I suppose."
He tried it out. It was easy to play. In fact, it was almost impossible to play badly. It didn't seem to matter how he touched the strings, they still rang out the tune he had in mind. It was in solid form the kind of instrument you dream about when you first start to play, the one you can play without learning. He remembered when he'd first picked up a harp and struck the strings, confidently expecting the kind of lambent tones the old men coaxed from them. He'd got a discord instead. But this was the instrument he dreamed of.
"Well, stick to the numbers everyone knows," said the dwarf. "The wizard's staff and gathering rhubarb, stuff like that. People like songs they can snigger along to."
Imp looked down at the bar. It was filling up a bit now, but his attention was drawn to a large orangutan which had pulled up its chair right in front of the stage and was holding a bag of fruit.
"Glod, there's an ape watching us."
"Well,"
said Glod, unfolding a string bag,
"it's an ape."
"This is Ankh-Morpork. That's how things are here."
Glod removed his helmet and unfolded something from inside.
"Why have you got a string bag?" said Imp.
"Fruit's fruit. Waste not, want not. If they throw eggs, try to catch 'em."
Imp slung the guitar's strap over his shoulder. He tried to tell the dwarf, but what could he say? This is too easy to play? He hoped there was a god of musicians, and there is. There are many, one for almost every type of music. Almost every type. But the only one due to watch over Imp that night was Reg, god of club musicians, who couldn't pay much attention because he'd also got three other gigs to do.
"We ready?" said Leas, picking up his hammers.
The others nodded.
"Let's give 'em the wizard's staff, then," said Glod. "That always breaks the ice."
"Okay,"
said the troll. He counted on his fingers.
One, two, many, lots."
The first apple was thrown 7 seconds later. It was caught by Glod, who didn't miss a note. But the first banana curved viciously and grounded in his ear.
"Keep playing," he hissed.
Imp obeyed, ducking a fusillade of oranges. In the front row, the ape opened his bag and produced a very large melon.
"Can you see any pears?"
said Glod, taking a breath.
"I like pears."
"I can see a man with a throwing axe.
Does it look valuable?"
An arrow vibrated in the wall by Leas's head. It was 3 in the morning. Sergeant Colon and Corporal Nobbs were reaching the conclusion that anyone who intended to invade Ankh-Morpork probably wasn't going to do so now, and there was a good fire back in the watchhouse.
"We could leave a note,"
said Nobby, blowing on his fingers.
"You know, come back tomorrow, sort of thing."
He looked up.
A solitary horse was walking under the gate arch, a white horse with a sombre, black-clad rider. There was no question of, halt, who goes there? The night watch walked the streets at strange hours and had become accustomed to seeing things not generally seen by mortal men. Sergeant Colon touched his helmet respectfully.
"Evening, your lordship," he said.
Good evening." The guards watched the horse walk out of sight.
"Some poor bugger's in for it, then," said Sergeant Colon. "He's dedicated, you got to admit it," said Nobby. "Out all hours, always got time for people." "Yeah."
The guards stared into the velvety dark. Something not quite right, thought Sergeant Colon.
"What's his first name?" said Nobby.
They stared some more. Then Sergeant Colon, who still hadn't quite been able to put his finger on it, said,
"What do you mean, what's his first name?" "What's his first name?" "He's Death," said the sergeant. "Death? That's his whole name. I mean, what do you mean? You mean, like, Keith Death?"
"Well, why not?
He's just Death, isn't he?" "No, that's just his job. What do his friends call him?"
"What do you mean, friends?"
"All right, please yourself. Let's go and get a hot rum. I think he looks like a Leonard."
Sergeant Colon remembered the voice. That was it, just for a moment there.
"I must be getting old," he said. "For a moment there, I thought he sounded like a Susan."
"I think they saw me," whispered Susan, as the horse rounded a corner.
The Death of Rats poked its head out of her pocket.
"Squeak." "I think we're going to need that raven," said Susan. "I mean, I think I understand you. I just don't know what you're saying."
Binky stopped outside a large house, set back a little from the road. It was a slightly pretentious residence, with more gables and mullions than it should rightly have, and this was a clue to its origins. It was the kind of house built for himself by a rich merchant when he goes respectable and needs to do something with the loot.
"I'm not happy about this," said Susan. "It can't possibly work. I'm human. I have to go to the toilet and things like that. I can't just walk into people's houses and kill them."
"Squeak?"
"Well, all right, not kill, but it's not good manners, however you look at it."
A sign on the door said, "Tradesman to rear entrance."
"Do I count as a..."
"Squeak!"
Susan normally would never have dreamed of asking. She'd always seen herself as a person who went through the front doors of life. The Death of Rat scuttled up the path and through the door.
"Hang on, I can't..."
Susan looked at the wood. She could. Of course she could. More memories crystallized in front of her eyes. After all, it was only wood. It had rot in a few hundred years. By the measure of infinity, it hardly existed at all. On average, considered over the lifetime of the multiverse, most things didn't. She stepped forward. The heavy oak door offered as much resistance as a shadow.